Blog Talk Radio.
Stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you have done.
Hello there, and good evening. Welcome to NASCA, the Stepchild of Peace Now Blog Talk Radio Show. NASCA is the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Victoria Kelly, and I'm your host for this evening, and my co-host is Vinny. We are on scan number 3249, and I'm excited to interview our special guest this evening. However, first, we have a single purpose at NASCA, which is to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional trauma, and neglect, and do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, or CSA. Presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Again, we are on number 3249. And if you'd like to be a part of the panel this evening, please call 646-595-2118. And my co-host will be on the back line and ask if you'd like to ask a question or have anything to say. And we'd love to have you join us and support our guests and join in the conversation. And our special guest this evening is Jaime Romo from San Diego, an educator, consultant, author, and minister who promotes prevention and healing for childhood sexual abuse, particularly abuse by religious authorities or in the context of religious settings. A workbook he wrote, Healing the Sexually Abused Heart, a workbook for survivors, drivers, and supporters, is an integration of various disciplines that allows Jaime to become a certified traumatic incident reduction facilitator. Jaime explains, while it's no secret that I am a survivor of clergy abuse, it is the journey of integration, transformation, and application that is most telling about my accomplishments and the life that I celebrate. Visit his website at www.jaineromo.org. On these episodes, we welcome various co-hosts, survivor professionals, non-professionals who will assist in fielding questions and lead a variety of topics suggested by our call and participants. Their trauma-informed perspectives as survivor professionals will help them guide the discussions on issues of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality. That brings some questions and topics brought to you, our listeners. Everyone's invited to engage on tonight's show. Please visit the NASCA, NASCA.org website. So, without further ado, hello there, Jaime, and how are you this evening?
I'm well, thank you. I always appreciate the work of this group, formally and informally, all the work that members do to help each other to heal and grow. So, thank you.
Yes, thank you for being on tonight. Well, enjoy having you. So, we were talking earlier, and you did have a topic that you wanted to bring up and discuss.
I do. And, you know, as you've mentioned, I mean, trauma is really kind of a worldwide pandemic. I mean, we've inherited so much from previous generations, and there are individual experiences and collective, and you know, so all of it really, really matters. And I think one of the biggest impacts of trauma is that we can disconnect from our own sense of who we are, our own sense of purpose and, you know, meaning of, like, what does my life mean? And so I'll just share briefly, in before offering this reflection or poem, the context. I mean, because I don't think what I internalized from the abuse that I experienced, you know, some of that was neglect, some of that was just, you know, poverty and things that I didn't have. And some of it was, you know, an alcoholic environment, so there was a lot of violence, and there was a lot of negative communication. And then there was sexual abuse as well, layered on top of all of that. And I think the disconnect for me was that I was a person of worth, and that I was a person who had some who had some enough worth that I didn't have to prove my worth. So my coping mechanism after being abandoned and abused and wrapped in shame was, I think, to abandon myself in a way and overachieve. And so I went to private high school across town on scholarship. We could never have afforded. I went to a private university, went to Stanford, and that was, you know, all very driven by getting away from wherever I grew up. And still, and then afterwards, whatever degrees or positions I had in education, kind of still I carried around this deep shame. And so the healing process has been to believe and be present, you know, believe in my worth, and not just in my head, but, you know, deep, to be present to myself, to be good to myself, and then to acknowledge. And so that's the
that
context.
That can be a long road for many of us. Long road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's the context that is not, I think, unique. And I think a lot of people might feel like that they've had to abandon themselves in some way, or they've, you know, haven't treated themselves well, or they haven't been proud of themselves. In fact, they may have felt shame and so on. And so here's this reflection. I'm just going to open this as kind of more than a rhetorical question. Like, if we don't really believe this, like deep in our bones, in ourselves, because we've had the muscle memory of internalizing so much negative, maybe what's some ways that we can get closer to this deep sense of being enough, of being sacred? So here it is. You are a miracle walking. I greet you with wonder. In a world which seeks to own your joy and your imagination, you have chosen to be free every day as a practice. I can never know the struggles you went through to get here, but I know you have swum upstream, and at times it's been lonely. I want you to know I honor the choices you made in solitude, and I honor the work you have done to belong. I honor your commitment to that which is larger than yourself, in your journey to love the particular container of life that is you. You are enough. Your work is enough. You are needed. Your work is sacred. You are here, and I am grateful. That's a reflection by Adrienne Marie Browner.
Wow. Powerful.
So for a long time, yeah, I didn't. I mean, in my head, maybe I thought I was good. There was a time where I had a very deep kind of spiritual awakening, and that resulted in feeling like, oh, yeah, everything is sacred, but it was disembodied. It was not connected, and it was without having resolved a lot of wounds, a lot of trauma, and so the journey has been to fully face the things that have maybe led to a disconnect or led to shame, and integrate so that that kind of reflection of being sacred and being enough is real. So I guess that's where I wanted to start and invite, you know, others' journeys. And
yeah. Well, you mentioned not liking yourself. I got to the point of hating myself, so I'm wanting to do self-harm. I used to cut at myself and wanting to die, you know. I just stopped, and I didn't want to die because I wanted to be out of this world because the pain was so bad, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't succeed, fortunately, because I'm in a whole new place now, you know. But like I said, it's a long journey, you know. You don't just get from hating to loving yourself, you know, overnight revelation. And, you know, some people say, tell me to stand in front of the mirror and say, I love you, I love you, I love you. But, you know, that's just not right for them, you know. And you know, there's a lot of things you could say that just, you know, you're the most fantastic person in the world, you know. I could say, I'm proud of you, you know, and we're going to have a great day today, you know. Something positive. I know when I focus on the negative that kind of gets me down a rabbit hole. I get thinking of all kinds of negative stuff. And not that, you know, you have to ignore when you're going through a hard time, because we all have bad days. But I used to have bad days, bad months, bad years. Now I have bad moments. And, you know, there's a big difference.
Yeah. I mean, and I want to highlight that the feeling, you know, when we're in the midst of a deep pain, we want it to stop. And then so plenty of writers that, you know, Gabor Mate is the myth of normal, and Bruce Perry and Oprah have that book, What Happened to You? And all those, you know, they just describe, you know, what so many know, that people cope in different ways. We want the pain to stop. And so maybe it's numbing, or maybe it's certain behaviors that are distracting. But, I mean, that's a big motivator that, sure, a lot of people will do anything to make it stop.
Yeah. Well, I have a good thing to tell you guys. 2 days from now, Saturday, I'll have 37 years sober from drugs and alcohol.
Wow, beautiful.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's a lifetime.
Thank you.
37 years.
Everybody says, that's a lot of 1 days at a time. I said, no, it's a lot of 1 moment at a time. Matter of fact, whenever I put how many years I have sober, I go out on Google and Google how many seconds is that. And I put down how many seconds I have instead of how many years. And I said, you know, every second I had to make a decision not to use, there were many seconds of those years that I had to make a choice, you know, because it can only take a moment to lose it all.
Yeah.
But I have a poem I'd like to read to you. This is one I wrote. And
thank
it's
you,
called, The Strength of a Warrior Woman. I gather hope from hearing the struggles of those who have walked similar paths. Fragments of their stories parallel in mine. I grasp onto their words for the portion I savor as they saturate in mind and soul. I have been told I am courageous, that I have survived against unbeatable odds. Yet, when I find myself alone with my thoughts and my memories, survival is just not enough. My inner voice and my guides speak to me. They whisper their truths and teach my mind and fill my heart. I am more comfortable being with myself. Then the peaceful moments come as the breeze is passing through my being. My energy is capped. Creativity flows and is safer in the canvas. I never knew how to love myself, for my needs were not to be met. Given away, I always wondered what an awful baby I must have been. The voice from the mother of all ages insists that I have always been wanted and loved. The tears from days gone by swell up in my eyes and harden in my throat. Trapped inside are hopes I wonder if I shall ever see. When I am in need, the phone seems so far away, hanging cold and silent, out of reach on the wall. I push myself off the chair, forcing movement, grasp a hand of hope and trust. I seek out numbers from people who have promised to be there for me even when I am down, sinking into my depression. The phone's voice is a tone of emptiness and fear, tormenting my ears, soaking into my brain, yet I gain the courage to dial. Sparks fly through my senses and a voice reawakens my belief that I need not struggle alone anymore. Words flowing like music, you are accepting me just as I am. Not trying to put band-aids on me, not trying to cover my pain. Offering suggestions, not setting me up. There are no cliches, no insistent demands. A listening, concerned, supportive vocal tone helps me to believe that I deserve to live, to be happy, and that things will be okay. For you can hear my story and not try to make it go away. Not tell me to forget. Not silence my anger or tears, giving me permission to feel to the depths of my soul. Your acceptance helps me to believe that I have not gone crazy, that I can live with all my reality, accepting the past a moment at a time. As I am now just feeling again, your words are unlike those who judge and blame. You find our commonalities, showing me our struggles, holding many shared feelings. Your courage helps me to see the courage in myself. Your hope opens my eyes to the great opportunity of today. Living through in the moment fills my heart with joy. Knowing I have survived another crisis, knowing the care and concern moves through the phone line, filling my entire being. Help me to now take out my hidden writings, which have remained in storage, the ones I have been afraid to let another person's eyes see, another one judge. Help me transform them into rays of hope to others. I return to my writing and drawing, hoping to each day somehow tap into the strength and compassion that I have been privileged to receive. I discover my truths and weave words and ideas to share a bit of the gifts which I have gained. I try to give freely of myself the joy which I have found. O Mother of the Earth, remind me to visit nature, stand sure-footed on your sacred soil. Remind me of my roots, give me strength, nourish me up through the ground. Enlighten me with the wisdom and lives of the warrior women who have come and gone before me. Remind me of your love that speaks through the voices and from the souls of the ones you have sent me. Those who give their gifts freely, sharing their secrets hidden beneath layers of pain, opening up their wounds for a chance to help another. Inviting the exchange of words, mixing souls together, transforming the beauty of the moment into the memories of a life, into the history of all times. The end.
Beautiful.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And hopefully that'll be one of the poems that's going to be in my book. I've got two women writing my story. There are two women studies professors at Oregon that heard that I had written a book, and it was just a book I put together, writings, and that was one of the writings in it. And they wanted to help. She wanted to help promote it, and I said, well, it's not really a book. It's just something I photocopied and sold 90 copies, so I had enough money to photocopy many more to give away, you know. Laminated the cover of a picture when I was a year old called The Journey Within. And she said, oh, I'd like to buy a copy. I says, oh, well, when email came out, I just got an email, and people, you know, somebody jealous of them. Like, will you email me one? I go, sure. Well, then she contacted me again and said her and her both of them are professors at this university. They would like to do a book, like my story told to them. And they would use some of my writings and drawings and stuff that I've done. And so I sent them a whole bunch of stuff, and then I grabbed all my journals and all the stuff I've written, and I boxed them up and sent them to them. I tried to write a book so many times, and because I had MPD, there's different personalities that wrote in there, and I didn't not know where to start or anything, you know. So I was just like, oh, thank God. Somebody's going to take these off my hands.
Yeah.
It's so scary. And I'm like, you know, the only point of me writing anything, you know, was for me to get it out and then hide it. You know, like I said, I had to take it out of hiding. And then to want to publish it, and I, you know, it would have never gotten done if these women hadn't said we'll do it, you know. And, but anyway, so I said, even if they do, I said, the most important part to me was to help other survivors know they weren't alone. And the second thing was for anybody that wanted to help survivors. And then the third part is anybody that's just curious. I'd like to have it all in a book so that I don't have to keep, you know what I mean? If somebody just is like interested, you know, then I wouldn't have to, like, you can read the book and you don't miss nothing kind of thing. So, you know, I'm just happy if it gets out there, to tell you the truth. That's my hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's
very
one
exciting.
Of the, yeah. You know, they've got, I don't know, they had three New York publishers interested, and they just got the editors working on it, and they're ready to get the chapter in, and they picked the publisher, and I don't know. They said that, you know, I get whatever out of it, and they're just going to take out what time they put into doing it, you know. And I get the rest, and I'm like, oh, I would cross them out, cross them out. What's the difference, you know? I don't know. Sometimes you just got to, you know, kind of just give up a lot of stuff and just trust that maybe she is telling you the truth. And if they're not, then blow with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope that really evolves and becomes something. Yeah.
And something good has already love it because I've been able to share more of my story, you know, and let people know that, yeah, you know, I'm getting a book wrote on my story, but there's other people that have gotten books published, and, you know, to encourage them to read other people's stories as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was just thinking it's a beautiful metaphor in that, you know, there's our own experience and our own sorting things out and expressing them in writing and so on. And then, you know, other people might see something from a different perspective. And we, you know, in writing, we revise. Right? Good writing is all about lots of hard revision. And this can send me a metaphor about our lives. I mean, we have the kind of the raw material, and then we have some insight or way of thinking about it, but then we have to revise, and maybe other people have some perspective that eventually it evolves. The idea that it can reach others, I mean, our stories are always interconnected.
Right.
There's a great song when the chorus says, what you need, I need to, who you are, I am too, we're all the same under a different name. You know, I mean, there's something important about each of our experiences can offer, you know, some insight or an entry point for someone else to know, as you said, that you're not alone.
Yeah.
Community is how we heal. So this is another way of letting yourself, you know, be taken up in community, and I hope that they honor that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we've been working together for a couple of years, and we've done a bunch of meetings together. And matter of fact, we got all the journal I sent her. She says, oh, my goodness, we have more than one book here. You know, and I'm like, well, that's great, you know, because I've got my survivor story from cancer and kidney failure and, you know, a lot of different things that I've been through that, you know, I've told the different stories here and there at AA, whether I'm the speaker or in a meeting. And I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, wow, you really inspired me, you know, went through all that cancer and you didn't drink, you know, or you went through this or that loss or that struggle or whatever. And how did you stay sober? And I'm like, well, I didn't drink. Went to meeting with my sponsor. I, you know, didn't an act right thing, just, you know, the stuff they tell you that's stupid, but it's really real.
Yeah.
I mean, still, you know, people ask me, why after all these years you still go to meetings? And I says, well, I go to meetings so I can share with other people, but I also go to meetings for me. I've seen too many people for 10 years, 15, 30, whatever, and they go back out. Because they forgot. The way I look at it, you know, because I can get back into thinking, like, even to this day, you know, I can get back to thinking, you know, I bet I could pick up a drink and drink like a normal person.
Yeah. Well, and so people like Bruce Perry, people like, of course, Gabor Mate, others, researchers will say that, of course, these are addictions are the end result, not the starting point, the end result of, you know, trauma and things that, wounds that where there's no blood, where person has coped in different ways and sought outside themselves for.
Well, you talked in the beginning too about the generational stuff. I mean, I saw my parents, I saw my grandparents, I saw family members and their friends. The way they dealt with issues that were child was drinking and using drugs.
Yeah.
And not being responsible at all, you know.
Yeah.
And I always felt that I had to be the responsible one and keep everything together, you know, all the time. I mean, I was really the parent.
Yeah.
You know, most of the time. And I used to think, until I got into Ellen, and I used to think that we were poor, and that's when my grandparents drank, and then I realized we were poor because they drank. We didn't have a lot more money if they had been drinking it away. All weekend and, you know, every night. It's amazing that, you know, when you, like, you know, it's a whole different reality when you start looking at, you know, what facts that really was going on. And I sent my brother a meme one time that said, the black sheep of the family is usually the one telling the truth. And so I was talking to him, and he hadn't gotten it yet, so I said, hey, I sent you something. It says, the black sheep of the family is usually the one telling the truth. Took him a few minutes, he goes, oh, I guess there was a black sheep of the family. I know you sure were. Because he was always getting in trouble for telling. He wasn't supposed to tell, you know. He told me and my brothers, because he lived with my aunt. So we were told we were cousins. But when he was with my brother, you know. And I had my other brother was living with me, so he told us that we were brothers and sisters, you know. And he got in big trouble with that. Matter of fact, I asked him if he'd speak one night on the radio show. I invited him to be a guest, and he said he would. He's got to wait till things calm down. But, you know, he said he'd come on.
Oh.
So I'm trying to get it. Yeah.
Like themes and, you know, aspects of what you read and so integration as, you know, that's the practice that helps us to heal and create. But he lives with your aunt and your brother, you're remembering and parts of your own experience. Holding on. There's this quote I read recently by Brown, you know, I was in a concentration camp.
I don't know if it's my phone or your phone, but you're kind of crackling. Are you hearing everything okay?
I hear a little bit of interruption.
Yeah, it's kind of crackling on your end. I mean, yeah, there's something in between your reception.
I may be in a bad
location. Are you on speakerphone, honey?
Right now I'm on speaker. I just took out my little headpiece. I'm no longer driving.
Now you sound good.
It sounds better right now.
Okay. Well, in a minute I'll move to a different location. Hopefully that will be also better. But this Viktor Frankl, you know, he survived, you know, the Holocaust, and what an incredible, you know, life of suffering and loss and grief and trauma. But what he says in this quote reminds me kind of what you're saying, Victoria. I mean, you have all this life experience. He says, what you've experienced, no power on earth can take from you. Not only our experiences, but all we've done, whatever great thoughts we may have had,
and all that we've suffered, all this is not lost, though it's past. We have brought it into being. Having been is also a kind of being, and perhaps the surest kind. You've been all kinds of things, and and it sounds to me like, you know, all of those have been part of learning and growth and becoming a resource, and I think having insight that, as painful as it may have been, wouldn't have come otherwise. And so you can be a resource for others.
Yeah.
And your story is really rich. And, yeah, so this more than surviving. I mean, I think we overemphasize that. I mean, of course, we sometimes that's the best we can do is just get through something. But there is post-traumatic growth, and that's what I hope people can have more and more, and I hope your story, you know, will help people have that.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I had published one of my poems in one in a Battered Woman's Steel, and then one for Whisper, which is the organization I worked with, which was Women, Heart, and Systems of Prostitution Engaged in Revolt, like we had an opinion. And the other was Organized Against Pornography. I had published it three times. And then Take Back the Night, something that was on the board for that, ended up asking me if I'd read it, Take Back the Night, and I read it. And, boy, it says, you know, speak your truth even if your voice shakes. I tell you, my voice shook, eyes shook. I cried through the whole thing. And I'm sure nobody understood it. And I got off the stage, and people came up to me and thanked me for saying it and how much they could relate to it. And right at that moment, I thought, I've got to keep writing, you know. And I've got to get those poems and those writings I've written before and get them out of storage. Or, you know, I was going through all my papers with my worker, and we were organizing, and I said, yeah, that goes in that file, and this is for that, and this is for that, and he's putting them in files, and... And every once in a while, I'd grab a paper and shove it to the side, and he's like, what are you doing with those papers? What are those? And I says, oh, those are just some poems I wrote and some writings I wrote. He goes, would you read me one? I said, sure. So I read him one. He goes, that's really good. He says, I'm putting a journal together by and for people with mental illness at the time. And he says, I was wondering, would you want to put, you know, one of your poems in there? And I said, yeah, I guess I could. So anyway, we went around to different drop-in centers. He had gotten a grant through this Minnesota Arts or something. And we put together this journal for 3 years in a row. People put their writings in there and artwork. And that's back when there were word processors. So they were mailing them in to the church where we're teaching people how to do word processors. People gave us their, you know, computer, whatever you want to call it at the time. And he'd pick them all up and stuff because... They couldn't do that, and didn't like the grammar and all that. So yeah, that was really cool, you know. But so here's that poem. It's called. Wait a minute, that's not one I'm reading. Hold on. Hold on, Ned. Yeah, is it? That's not it. Hold on a minute.
Were you gonna share another?
Yeah, I'm trying to find it here. Okay, yeah, it's called Who's a Prisoner? Do you know what it's like to be protected only in the presence of closed shades and locked doors? Even then, at times, feel safe. Daddy walks around going wherever he may please. I once was a prisoner, but he still holds the keys. The law says he can't harm me. The time goes slowly by. Do they know the torture that's so present with every chair I try? I can't tell them how much it hurts me to know they let him roam. Do they know I'm still in prison, a place I should call home? The law was meant to protect me, yet it's so unfair. I wait and cry for justice as my abuser roams and breathes the air.
Hmm.
Like I said, it wasn't a very long poem, and you know, I didn't think I was going to get through it. When I got there, people, I wasn't even going to get up the stage to do it. I'm like, there's too many people up there. There's no way, you know. And I had never really gotten up in front of anybody and said anything about my incest story.
Yeah.
At that point, that was years ago.
Yeah. I mean, this, I have been to be reading the book, Just Mercy, Brian Stevenson. Mm-hmm. You know, he's an attorney in Alabama who has the Equal Justice Initiative, which is about, you know, dealing with people on death row who often have, you know, are falsely accused or just had, they shouldn't be, you know, where they are. To talk about prisoners and talk about torture and injustice, what helped you to become more free? I mean, it doesn't happen just individually, right?
Well, part of it was I stayed inside my house when I escaped from him in 21. Stayed in my house for 3 years. So I did feel totally, physically and physically.
Mm-hmm.
And just going out, you know, to the store and stuff was a big deal. My grandparents were bringing me in groceries and, you know, things I needed and taking out my trash. I mean, I would not leave my house. Scared to death he was out there because he said, you know, if I don't find you, I'll send somebody to find you. So I was afraid to make any friends or anything, you know. So what I did do when I started working, I ended up going to Better Women's Shelter after my son. I would start going out, and then I met my son's father. He was abusive, and I ended up in Better Women's Shelter. That's when I started volunteering with Better Women's Shelter. And that helped me a lot to be in there and just get some information about abuse. Because I was really, you know, naive. You know, I figured abuse was getting smacked in the face. You know, and that had never happened ever in my life. So, you know, I didn't even see myself as an abuse victim, really. And, you know, just I think a lot of times it's learning, you know, different definitions. You know, like when I first went to the police, you know, the cop asked me, you know, what happened. And the first thing I said was, well, I was at my dad's house and he made love to me. So he told me, you know, that's what he called it, and that's what I had to call it. And so he stopped me right there, and he says, hold on a minute, I'm going to rewind the tape. I thought, what the hell is he doing? You know, I thought we're going to get this over with. And so he goes, I'm going to ask you that question a different way. He says, when you were going over to your dad's, you got over there, did you want to have sex with him? And I said, absolutely not. So that's what was on the tape instead. I went over and, you know, yeah. So, I mean, sometimes it's learning the definitions, but also having people that have been through it, to me, was very important. Not necessarily, I did go to psychiatrists and therapists, and stuff, but the most important thing was meeting other survivors, because I didn't feel like such an oddball, you know? Yeah, so alone and so confused, and everyone else in that group was confused, too. So we're doing the support group. And we all had a lot of the same issues, the disassociation, the trauma, the flashbacks, you know, all that. Mm-hmm. Nobody else would have really understood it, you know. I mean, but they don't usually explain to you what's going on. I'd had a really good psychologist. I ended up being diagnosed with MPD, versus borderline personality disorder, which was a wrong diagnosis. And I had MPD, and in the end, they found out I had like 31 personalities in fragments. And so I was switching all the time.
Yeah.
And these different personalities were doing things, and I didn't know what was going on half the time or more than half the time. I'd lose months and weeks and days and years, and I wouldn't know what was going on. And that was horrible, especially when I was, you know, diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, because when I was in the psych ward, they'd write down doing this or that attention. I'd crawl under the table and start shaking and whimpering, and they'd write down I was able to get attention. Well, when they finally diagnosed me with MPD, they wrote down she crawled under the table when she's in a dissociative state.
Right.
You know, and they'd be really kind to me. There's a really different way that people deal with you depending on your levels. And that's why they, you know, put the person before the label, and know, some people will say, well, he's a schizophrenic or whatever I used to say. I'm a multiple, you know. And then I learned to say, you know, I was diagnosed with PD, you know, and it's called dissociative identity disorder now. I had my son was diagnosed with ADHD, so I'd always say, I'm an ADHD kid. And they said, put your child before the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
The person before the diagnosis. And make sure you say it's a diagnosis. That's not what they are. You're not your diagnosis.
Right.
So it's like when I had cancer, somebody would say, she's cancer.
Right.
You know, yeah. You know, she's borderline. No, she's not borderline. She's diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, you know, or she's diagnosed. There's a real big difference in, you know, even the way we say it about ourselves, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I was just in a conversation yesterday. It was somebody who was looking at disabilities as other abilities because,
mm-hmm.
you know, in so many ways, you know, people developed different strengths, skills, competencies, resilience,
mm-hmm.
any number of things as part of, okay, I can't do one thing, so now I have other. But it was part of that was saying, people may have a condition, but they're not that condition.
Right.
Not that disability. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. My girlfriend wanted to make a shirt that says, don't diss my ability.
Mm.
I thought that was cool. Because just think, let's focus on all the abilities we have, you know. And we have the ability to get through the disability, you know. We have a lot of abilities. We have a lot of coping skills. We have a lot of things that we succeed and, you know, succeed at that I would have never thought I could. I would have never thought I could, you know, get on a blog talk radio show with me a whole, you know. Never thought I could step and speak in front of people or, you know, even get my poems out of the boxes I have them in.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then I went to AA. My sponsor saw me guzzling out of a bottle and says, oh, Victoria, you think you might be an alcoholic? I go, oh, yeah, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm one of those alcoholics that can't be helped. And she said, oh, what kind of alcoholic is that?
Yeah.
Of course, she didn't ask me all the next day because it's really not helpful to talk to an alcoholic when they're drinking.
Right.
You know, but went to an AA meeting with her, and I've been sober ever since. But it was, I don't know, I always say she loved me before I could love myself. And I think that's a big part of it is, you know, caring about people where they're at.
Yeah.
You know, say that God cares about you right where you're at right now, you know. And, you know, if we believe that and we're supposed to be, you know, in the image of God or whatever, then we should be caring about people right where they're at and not trying to change them. You know, just love them right where they are.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that is compassionate, right?
Right.
And that's at the heart of, I would think, any authentic, true tradition is compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And then it goes to compassion for yourself, you know, because a lot of survivors... I do all kinds of wonderful things for other people. And for me, it was like I was on the bottom of the list. And I tell you what, everybody else came first, and I came never. Because there was always somebody that had more need than I did, in my opinion. You know, even when I had barely a little money and I was out on the street homeless, if I seen somebody that looked worse off than me, I'd give them my money.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm going to come because I knew where my next meal was coming from. I knew where the good place to go get food.
Yeah.
Or I'd tell them where the good food place was, you know.
And that kind of, it's generous, definitely, but it's also a kind of self-neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that relates to, you know, if I have a disconnect to my own body, to my own needs, to my own worth, then, I mean, I can seem nice and generous, you know, to give everything and not take care of myself.
Right.
Yeah, no,
well,
I say that.
Well, you don't deserve it, you know. Like, I was at one point where I didn't deserve, I didn't think I deserved food, shelter, clothing, or even to breathe the air because I felt like taking it away from somebody else. I mean, that's pretty, you know, feeling pretty shitty about yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it makes sense, though. I mean, that's kind of where I started. I mean, we internalize these things that happen to us, and we come up with that conclusion, which is not a matter of not being intelligent.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then I hear a lot of times people, you know, bad things happen to bad people and good things happen to good people. Well, I felt I must have been pretty damn bad, you know. And then when I'm in a meeting, a guy said that, and it's about three people popped after him. And I said, well, must have been pretty bad then to be raped as an infant. Must have been a pretty bad infant, you know. And everybody just looked at me. And then he never said that in a meeting. And he always said it in a meeting. He always said into his little blurb that he'd say when it was his turn, you know. Never said that again. And, you know. But, yeah, and just, you know, like for me now, I've got a house and this and that, you know, and my son made a condition that I can't let anybody stay here that doesn't have a place to live.
Yeah.
That's really hard for me.
Sure. Well.
Because I don't have an extra room, but, you know, I have a couch, I have the floor space, you know.
Yeah.
But now I can say my son said I can't, you know.
Right.
But
well,
it's almost like I need that. I shouldn't just be able to say stuff, you know. Somebody would bring something up that, you know, I really didn't want to do or whatever. And I'd literally have to say, I don't think my daughter's going to think that's a good idea, you know.
Yeah.
But because it was really hard for me to say no. So, like, me and my girlfriend would practice saying no. And we just bring up, like, really things like, hey, would you come over and scrub my kitchen floor with a toothbrush? Just practice. Because it's hard.
Yeah, no. It may sound, you know, playful, silly, but actually it requires the ego strength, you know, to be able to say, no, this is me, this is not me, this is good for me, this is not good for me.
Right. Well, it's like retraining your brain. I mean, you've got, for me, I had all these automatic responses, you know, growing up in a dysfunctional, alcoholic, sexually abused home. And I was in a psych ward one time, and I was sitting with these people. I first got in there, this group of people, so I just sat down, and the one guy told me, you see that girl over there by the window? And I said, yeah. And they said, she's really crazy. And I'm thinking, we're all sitting here in a psych ward locked up, but, you know, what we're doing, you know, picking out who's crazy or whatever, you know. So I thought, well, I gotta go back to her, because they're going to be saying that I'll be pretty soon, especially if she leaves. I'll be that one, you know. So I went over to talk to her, and we were talking. Finally, she said, what is your mother's name? I told her, and she goes, oh, my God, we're cousins. We're second cousins. Yeah, and she had been incested by her uncle. And ran away at 15 because he got put in jail even back then, which we're talking, I don't know, 40 years ago. And so it must have been horrible. And anyway, he got out and they gave him a party. I don't know why. I guess he had good behavior in jail or something. I'm not sure. They gave him a party and she was there. And all of a sudden they both disappeared and they went looking for him. And he was up raping her in a room. And, I guess all the guys decided that jail wasn't going to do them any good, so they just all beat the shit out of them. She took off, and that's the last time she went home.
Wow.
Yeah, and so her two brothers came to visit her, and I knew her brothers. I'd never met her. And they came in, and we were playing cards and stuff, and they said, let's just get out of here. Let's just go get drunk or high or something, you know. And we both checked ourselves in. We could check ourselves out. So, you know, they're talking to her, this and that, and we're never going to change nothing anyway. We might as well just go, you know, have a good time, blah, 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 you know. And so she gets all excited, and they just take off, you know. And I'm just frozen there, and all of a sudden I grab one of the staff, and I said, I need a one-on-one right now. So I went into a room with the staff and said, tell me it's not true, you know, because I had a daughter, mm-hmm. and I didn't want to believe that, you know, just had to keep repeating.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my biggest motivator, I think, was that, you know, I had a child and I wanted to change her
yeah.
life. And I knew I had yeah. to be healthier, you know, or I was going to just pass the mental health, regardless of if I was, say, abusing her. I couldn't properly take care of her because of my mental health, you know, so I knew
sure.
I'd keep getting the health help.
Yeah.
So I wasn't in resistance, and I think that's one of the biggest things is, you know, being open to getting help, too, because,
yeah.
you know, somebody can call me up and, you know, I can try to help them, and give them a whole bunch of ideas, and they keep saying, no, that ain't going to work, but they're not willing to try anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying that might work or, you know, yeah, I'll go do that. You know, you can't help somebody that doesn't want help. It's the same with AA, you know. We get a lot of people in there that are court or they don't want to be here. Now, sometimes it's
yeah.
things and they do be sober, you know. But there's a lot of them that are just, you know, they come in kicking and screaming and then leaves kicking and screaming. You know, they're so glad to go and they don't have to go anymore and they got their paper signed every week and now they're not on probation anymore and they just go back out and use again.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to pee in a cup, you know.
Right.
So
what you mentioned right there, motivation, I think is, so when I, you mentioned in the intro that I'm a TIR, Traumatic Incident Reduction Facilitator. I'm also a trainer. And so traumatic incident reduction is a very focused trauma-specific way of processing all kinds of experiences or stressors, you know, some things that are ongoing that impact us and some things that are specific, that once we fully face them, it does shift us. We have less material that gets triggered. And so I bring this up because you said the motivation piece. You know, it works when, one, a person is motivated. They know they want to feel better. They want to have some have helped better physical, mental health, relationships, be able any number of things. It works with that. And then when someone is not under the influence of something, so they can think clearly to be able to fully face or remember things and for themselves put pieces together. But the other piece, I mentioned ego strength. You know, when we can kind of hold on to the discomfort of going through this process, when we can follow directions because it's a facilitated process. But that motivation piece is huge. When that is there, when a person is really wants to heal, to grow, especially, you know, in an accelerated kind of way,
mm-hmm.
that makes all the difference. And so suggestions.
I think you're talking about hope, because like I always said when I came into the doors of AA, I was hopeless. I was a hopeless alcoholic, and I knew I could not get sober, you know.
Mm.
And when I walked in and I listened to my sponsor talk, I can't tell you what she said, but I cried the whole thing. And the one thing I got out of it was hope. Hope that I could get better.
Yeah.
You know, and some people really figure that this is the way I'm going to be the rest of my life. I really believe that. This is just the way I'm going to be the rest of my life. I'm going to be in this kind of pain. I'm going to have these flashbacks. I'm going to have body memories. I'm going to be tormented every single day, you know.
Mm.
And not believing there was, you know, yeah, it was a tough ride through, but, you know, the other side, you know, like, you know, somebody was saying, you know, people say that they're survivors, light show survivors. You know, they're like eating bugs and stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you know, like going on or, you know, being stranded out in the ocean and then you get onto the land and you like crawl out, you know, you crawl into the water and you get on land or whatever and you crawl on and you got goop all over your hair, you know, and seaweed and you're starving and everything else. And then you get up on the land and, you know, you find some place to get shelter and you finally find some place to, you know, get back to your home or whatever and cleaned up and, you know, you can start living again. But, you know, we never think that we're going to start living again. That's the big part.
Yeah. Well, one, I've had plenty of discussions with people about those shows, that this, you know, a contrived way to show that people are resilient, or, you know, but a lot of people live in survival in terrible conditions where it is life and death. It is real.
Yeah.
And so those shows to me are fairly meaningless. But
yeah.
that point.
Well, you know, in a certain amount of time, you're going to get out of there.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that there is a safety net.
Yeah.
But it seems like you used the safety net just by reaching out several times, different ways, different groups.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and many different groups because, you know, I was a survivor of prostitution, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was a battered woman, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
I served at a battered women's shelter and, you know, was a support group there. And, you know, when there was a volunteer opportunity, I said, yeah, I'll do that. Get involved.
Mm.
I had made some friends there, you know. And we started doing it. It was called an outreach program. And, you know, we would go to the shelter and talk to the women. And I went out and went to a flower shop and asked them if they had any roses. And they had a bunch of flowers that they weren't going to use. You know, they were going to be ready to throw them out, but they were still pretty, you know. So I grabbed them and... Yeah, I went to a garage sale and bought all these vases and stuck them in there and brought them over for Mother's Day. And, you know, just different things like that. And then every year we put on this huge Christmas party. We were at 150 women and children. We gave cookies and stuff there. And we had Santa Claus there. And what we did is we took a picture with the mom and the children of each family, you know.
Mm.
And it was really because, you know, whether they had a man, you know, I don't know. I always thought the family was a mom, dad, and kids, you know. So I went to the shelter, and they called me a family with me and my two kids.
Mm.
It kind of threw me off. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I took pictures of the families and gave them the pictures. And one lady came up to me 3 years after she had been to one of them and says, you know what? Those 3 years, those are the only pictures I ever had in my kids because I couldn't afford a camera to film.
Mm.
So you just don't know what you're giving people when it could be the smallest. You know, you think it's the smallest thing, it can be a lot to somebody.
Yeah.
I was volunteer with the Lions Club, too. And there's a Lions Club camp. Kids with disabilities up in Kerrville, Texas. And anyway, so we go out and do the fairs every year in our little area we were in. And we had so many parents come up to us and say, our kids still talking about that. They went 5 years ago to there. They're still talking about how much fun they had, you know,
because
all the kids can go for free. And, they just enjoy themselves so much. Just, it's nice to get that feeling, you know, of helping somebody. But, you know, but now I can do that, but I can still take care of myself, you know, and, you know, go beyond just food, shelter, and clothing. I can, you know, say, hey, I think I'll take myself up out for a cup of coffee. You know, I really worked hard this week in my house clean or today or whatever. I think I'll take myself out for dinner.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, or it's just, you know, a really nice day. I think I'll go for a walk and do something fun, you know.
Yeah. So I am happy to hear, I mean, that you have that, and it's a good example for others, and I want to read another poem.
Yeah.
We've kind of got a poem theme happening. It's not my own. It's from Hafiz, who's, I believe, a 14th century Persian poet, writer, and really sounds like more of a mystic. And this may sound aspirational, but it's this idea of self-care and recognizing that we are good and sacred and could be celebrated. So here it is. It says, I sometimes forget that I was created for joy. My mind is too busy. My heart is too heavy. Heavy for me to remember that I've been called to dance, the sacred dance for life. I was created to smile, to love, to be lifted up, to others up. O sacred one, untangle my feet from all that ensnares. Free my soul that we might dance and that our dancing might be contagious. So, I hear in you, this being freed up, but
you know, having come through a lot, but that the more untangled we are, you know, the better for others. There's that poem by Marianne Williams, Our Deepest Fear, you know, that idea that, you know, who are we to shine and who are we not to be? You know, the more that we are, I forget her wording, but the more that we are freed up, it gives others permission. So it's both a gift for ourselves, but also it's part of being contagious for others.
Yeah.
Being a resource.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of the going to support groups and stuff, because you can see, you know, how other people are learning to take care of themselves too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm sure I read this before, but this is the Serenity Prayer from NASCA. Says, please grant me the serenity to stop beating myself up for not doing things perfectly, the courage to forgive myself because I always try my best, and the wisdom to know that I am a good person with a kind heart.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, and that's something that we consider ourselves, which isn't, you know, looking in the mirror and saying you're beautiful or whatever, you know, I'm a good person with a kind heart.
Yeah.
And, you know. You don't have to be an extraordinary, you know, Mother Teresa kind of person, you know. Just, you know, even going by somebody on the street and smiling at them and saying hi. You know, you don't know if that person's ever had many people smile at them.
Yeah.
Or said something kind to them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's reality. We just don't know.
Yeah. So I have two little Bichons, and I got a little girl, and I was going to breed her, but I was going to wait till she was a year old. But my male decided that we weren't waiting. So there was a 40% chance she was pregnant. Well, she's pregnant.
Okay.
We're going to be having puppies.
Nice.
And so that's quite the experience.
Well, so here's another. I happen to have my phone, my work phone, because I sometimes get these quotes from different, you know, writers, philosophers, spiritual teachers, and you know, I'm back to thinking about the healing journey and the compassion that is the common ground, I think, of any authentic tradition, spiritual tradition. So this is from Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Buddhist who's now, you know, passed, but he was, and his monks were persecuted for practicing, you know, Buddhism. And his whole community was about compassion, as you know, as so is the Dalai Lama, so is so many traditions. But this is about growth and change. It says, when you plant lettuce, if it does not grow well, you don't blame the lettuce. You look for reasons it's not doing well. It may need fertilizer or more water or less sun. You never blame the lettuce. Yet if we have problems with our friends or family, we blame the other person. But if we know how to take care of them, they will grow well, like the lettuce. Blaming has no positive effect at all, nor does trying to persuade using reason and argument. That is my experience. No blame, no reasoning, no argument, just understanding. If you understand and you show that you understand, you can love and the situation will change. And I think, you know, that's back to, you know, we've been blamed, or you know, have interpreted that we blame ourselves for so many things, and such an important key to healing is to be, if not from ourselves, you know, that we learn compassion from others, that then we can believe it and practice it for ourselves. And I think I heard you say that with your sponsor, you know, someone who saw something that you couldn't see, and then little by little it becomes true, something true for you. But I just offer that as, like, for anybody who might be listening or any of us, you know, just to appreciate that that there are stages in growth, just like, you know, that happens in our bodies, you know, that we develop in our minds, we develop that inside us, this core of who we are, this goodness, call it sacredness, that continues to grow. And that's,
yeah.
And sometimes we can forget that that's who we are, that we're created for good.
Right. I like this one, you know, it's about, I think sometimes, a lot of times we compete with other people, you know. A lot of people are like really kind of looking at Facebook and going, you know, not everybody's life is those happy pictures all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And feel like you have to compete against everybody. And it says, a flower does not think of competing with the flower next to it. It just blooms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Zen Shin. Yeah. Just blooms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the support groups, the this kind of online community and the meetings that happen from it, they're about just each person sharing, you know, their growth, their learning, and it's not, I mean, it could feel like a competition, I guess. But,
yeah, and that's what I like about NASCA, by saying, you know, none of our experiences are worse or better than anybody else's. You know, child abuse should never happen to anyone, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, you know, like the poem I wrote was, you know, that I like sharing our commonalities rather than our differences.
Yeah.
And the reason why I brought my dogs is because my male dog I got first about 2.5 years ago, and I got him as a service dog. And I had him in the assisted living, and I told him 3 months before I was getting him that I was getting a service animal. And they were real upset with me, and then when I got him, they were even more upset. And every day was just like, felt like hell. You know, they were just tormenting me constantly about it and tried to kick me out a couple times and wouldn't let me bring him down where I got my medication and just all this stuff. I was fighting and kept saying, you know, I have a right. This Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, I got the papers up in my room. We don't care about your damn papers. We're not looking at, we don't care. You know, and I had a display law attorney to fight for me. And I mean, it was exhausting, you know, and when I found this place and there's a fenced in yard and everything, I was just so happy to get out of there. But, you know, I don't know. The place was really bad anyway. They weren't feeding us right, or they didn't do any of the activities they were supposed to and all this stuff. And they were messing with our meds, and it wasn't a good place to begin with. But, you know, just the fact that I was fighting for my dog, you know, and saying, I have a right to have him, I think kept me, like, motivated. And also we had an organization out here that helped with, like, animal costs, you know, like veterinarian care, just regular veterinarian care and things. And anyway, they – I was talking to him once, and they says, yeah, they've realized that with seniors and people with disabilities, they take better care of themselves when they have a pet, you know, because they get out and take them for walks, and, you know, they play with them, and, of course, you know, playing with the animal could be a really therapeutic, you know, regardless whether it's your service animal, emotional support animal, I think they all, you know, can be in tune with you, and, you know, when you feed them, they get all happy, and, you know, it can be good for your spirits, too. And and a lot of people don't know if they have PTSD that they can get a service animal. They know, most of them know they can get an emotional support animal, but not a lot of people know that that also qualifies you for a service animal, and they do not need to be trained. They do not need a vest. They do not need any of that stuff they say you need that you can send in all your money for. And I know this one lady saved all of this money so she could set in for the certificate and everything. Well, it's a doctor's certificate from the psychiatrist that doesn't even know you.
Yeah.
And it's paperwork that if you get caught with, you can get fined, because the ADA does not support that paperwork. And all you need to do is get a letter from your psychiatrist. And it doesn't need to be trained or anything, because the only requirement according to the ADA is that your service animal comforts you when you have a panic or an anxiety attack.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. The end.
Yeah.
And I've argued with so many people, they're this and that and this and that, and they bring up all these. And finally I just said, you know what? I stopped arguing and I stopped trying to convince them. I said, if you don't believe me, look up the Americans with Disabilities Act. I said, and if I'm wrong, come back and tell me, because I'd hate to be giving out the wrong information. Nobody's
mm-hmm.
ever come back to me.
Mm. Well, this, I appreciate you giving that background. Because I mentioned earlier, I mean, one of the big outcomes of some kind of trauma is that we become disconnected and we can lose our sense of meaning. You know? So who are we if we're not connected to ourselves or to others and sense of purpose?
Mm-hmm.
And so pets can serve as a kind of connection, you know, especially
yeah.
dogs who can be, you know, present and listen without judgment, which is very healing, and it would be a good example for anybody.
Yeah.
But so to be connected is not a small thing. And, you know, we share parts of the brain, you know, the basic, you know, limbic and lizard brain, and then the mammalian brain with so many pets. And so there's that basic connection that I think can help to help the person to be regulated again, because they're paying attention
yeah.
to something that is, you know, connected to us.
Well,
yeah, so
you know,
it's
like when
background.
I woke up in the morning, my dog would be all happy and jump on me, and you know what I mean? It was just like, there's somebody there that, you know, cared that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know a lot of people tell me, you know, well, I like animals better than I do people, you know. And it's like, that's okay, you know, because it's a way to, you know, like you said, connect, you know,
mm-hmm.
if you're connecting is really important. And I read this one thing that the lady says, I don't put all my problems on Facebook. I just go out and tell my squirrels,
mm.
you know, and I feed the squirrels, so I could kind of relate to that.
mm.
But I enjoy being out in nature, you know, for me, that's really relaxing. So I made a meditation area in my yard for myself, you know. And every once
yeah.
in a while, I'll go, you know, I got some old berries down there, and I made a little garden for them. And then I just bought some rocks and made a little pathways for them.
Mm. wow.
You know, yeah. So, you know, to me, that's really a lot of fun working in the yard and things like that, you know.
Yeah, there's what you're pointing to are all these really helpful healing practices about connecting and creating
yeah.
something beautiful and getting
mm-hmm.
outside. There's at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, however many years ago, there was this list that went out through, I don't know, maybe it was Facebook or something, but it was for like quarantine, since people were feeling so stressed out. But I think they're useful and practical for all kinds of, you know, healing work, you know. So one of the points is there's 6 points. Like, here's your to-do list. It says, what am I grateful for today? It's a good practice, of course. It actually changes the, you know, the way that our emotions and chemistry, you know, works for
mm-hmm.
us. Number two is, who am I checking in on or connecting with today? So the idea of connection.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, what expectations of normal am I letting go of today? So there's a certain amount of, yeah, just being present.
What was that one again?
Yeah. It says, what expectations of, quote, normal am I letting go of today? You know,
oh,
so
let
just
go.
The idea
okay.
of being present. And 12-step might say, let go and let God. But, yeah, just the idea of that we can pay attention and see what is changing or what is continuous that is important. Number four, how am I getting outside today? So you mentioned, you know, I work with people who are at the end of life, you know, and
yeah.
they appreciate, you know, many people, I mean, just appreciate the simple being outside to be able to connect with nature, to be in touch
right.
with something much bigger that reminds them that we're not just this body and just this time. And related, number five, how am I moving my body today? So whether that's exercise or gardening or cooking, you know, using this amazing body that we have. Number six, what beauty am I either creating, cultivating, or inviting in today? So you described creating this garden. And I think you said before you have artwork as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know that when I was in the nursing home, I was on two occasions. The one occasion, I had an ileostomy where they put that bag on the side of you. Mm-hmm. My testings were tied in knots, and they had to do an emergency one, and they have to cut you from the inside out, and you have to heal from the inside out, and it was pretty bad, and I couldn't get out of bed. They finally got me into a wheelchair, and they had this exercise thing, and most of the people that were in the nursing home were in wheelchairs, and they did exercise with us, you know. Everybody's like, oh, I can't do exercise, you know, that's too much or whatever. I mean, we sat in the wheelchairs and just moved our arms and our head and our neck, you know. It's like, you know, just do what you can. Exercise doesn't have to be this big routine or, you know. My girlfriend invited me to do the step thing over at her gym. All it was going up and down a step, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, I can go up and down the steps at home, you know, and get my housework done, you know. And, you know, you don't have to come all the way over here to get up and down on a piece of wood, you know. Mm. And we don't realize that, you know, we are moving. We are moving our bodies and give ourselves more credit.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's intentional, especially.
I mean, it's good to work out and everything if you can, but I'm just trying to say that some people, you know, limit themselves by saying, well, you know, I'm not in that good of a shape to go for a three-mile walk, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I was starting with going one block down the road and back.
Yeah.
And then one day I decided to go out with my walker, and I walked down the road, and I sat down every so often and went as far as I thought I wanted to, and then came back and, you know, sat down on the way back when I wanted to and just looked around and just took in what was around me and got back. And then I Googled how far I'd went. I'd went 5 miles. I would have never thought I could walk 5 miles.
Mm. Yeah.
Granted,
yeah.
I did sit down quite a bit, but I, you know. We're more capable of things than we can imagine.
Yeah. And for a while I've been thinking about, from what you said, it reminded me of, you know, different times where I accomplished something. And you mentioned you're going to celebrate, you said 37 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are some things that we can do that can be accomplishments, and they're good. Worth celebrating, worth recognizing. But I guess the question that has been in my mind for a bit has been, you know, as a result of these things that you've done, and I know I can answer for myself as well, and maybe Annie as well. Who have you become? You know, like all these things that you've done to connect, to heal, to help others, you know, to rebuild and so on. Those are all.
Well,
important.
I can tell you one thing. I changed my name a while back when I started speaking, because my biological father was still out there and I was scared to death that he was going to find me. So I looked up a name in a Christian name book and I changed my name. Hmm. Victoria means victorious.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruth was my middle name and I kept it, which means spirit. And Kelly means warrior. So it's victorious spirit warrior. And I didn't feel like that when I got the name, but I feel like it now. So that's my answer. That's who I am today, a victorious spirit warrior.
Well, thank you. So, and just one thought, an association I have with that is, and it relates, the warrior is different from a soldier, is different from some killer, right? So, I mean,
right.
It's someone who has endured
some kind of wound has grown.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an expression, follow no one who has no scars. And a warrior is someone then who has compassion, who understands the possibilities of destruction, of violence, and so on, and mm-hmm. and has not just survived that, but has grown, but isn't then out looking for revenge necessarily.
It's right.
To be able to be a resource, to be able to protect, to have that full energy and force, life force. That's wow.
Well, that's interesting, too, because I was talking to my psychiatrist today, and I was telling her that, you know, my dad was a very, very intelligent man. And I was always afraid if somebody told me I was even smart, let alone intelligent, you know. And I was really scared of that because he was so evil, you know.
Mm.
And it connected, you know. And then one day it just connected, and I went, it's okay to be smart and intelligent.
Mm.
It's what you choose to do with that intelligence. Is it to do good and do good for mankind and good for the world and good for yourself, you know, or do you choose the other? And we make choices like that all the time. And
so,
the other part of my name, the spirit part, is I'm a spiritual being, you know, living.
Mm-hmm.
Like we say, I don't know if other people do, but I say I'm a spiritual being in a human body, you know, living in this human experience.
Right. Yeah. Well,
but to get in touch with that inner spirit for me is just a lot of times just being calm, you know, like I tell people prayer and meditation is no big deal. I said prayer is just asking for guidance, and meditation is just listening for the answer. But you have to quiet down your mind enough that you can hear the answer.
Well, when you bring up, you bring up all kinds of really, I think, really great, you know, points and insights. The idea of not everybody who is intelligent is moral, but everybody who is moral is intelligent. So it means, you know, we have to discern. If you're moral, you're thinking of other people. And to do that, you have to make, you know, decisions. You have to analyze. You have to prioritize. You have to do all kinds of critical thinking, but it's in service of you know, compassion, of helping others. And,
right.
And so intelligence doesn't, in itself, is not as important as a lot of intelligent people who do a lot of harm.
That's right.
So, Annie, would you join in? Who have you become as a result of your life experience and growth?
Well, sure. I have become a completely different person. It's like the old Annie went away, and then now there's a new one. Because the person that I was hid in the house, terrified, and couldn't talk on the phone because I was just so afraid of people. And now I'm a person that can talk on the radio, and I'm not afraid of people. I like people. I like to meet new people and talk to them. It's just amazing because I could not talk to people. I was just terrified, really debilitated. And I wasn't helping anybody, you know, and now I am. Because I couldn't help anybody. I was too much in need myself to help anybody else.
Yeah.
And what else? Today I'm happy. I was never happy before. I suffered from depression, and I hated myself, and I hated my life, and I hated my job, and I was just so unhappy.
Mm.
And now I'm happy about everything. I love everything. I mean, if I had the same job, I would probably love it now because it's me. It's not the job. It's me. And, look, you know, being positive and optimistic.
Yeah, I went to visit Annie, and she's got a gorgeous yard. She's got a beautiful yard and house, and it's very nice. Her and her son built a waterfall that goes in, it almost looks like it's a river. It goes quite a ways. And it's just, it's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Beautiful. She's got a beautiful yard. And I mean, you could divide it up in like six different little areas for sitting. And I mean, it's just gorgeous.
Thank you.
She put a lot of care into the way she set it up.
It's a hobby, you know, it's something that I look forward to doing when I'm not, you know, having to do work and stuff like that. I don't see it as gardening as work. I see it as a joy. And I just learned today that plants can hear. I was listening to a book about the science of it. Plants can hear. I'm just so amazed by that I have to tell everyone. Maybe you already knew that.
Well, they talk to your plants, you know, and I tell people talk to your plants because they can hear you, you know.
Yeah,
I never knew there's a scientific basis, but I always believed it.
Yeah, they said that when the buzzing of a bee, even if it's not a real bee, even if it's only a buzzing sound, the flower puts nectar out in response to the sound. And other stuff, too. That was just one of the ones.
Wow.
I feel like the door has opened because now we know that plants and animals, too, are communicating with each other in ways that we had no idea.
Yeah.
And it's, it's so amazing and wonderful.
Yeah, there's a book I just read called The Flowering Wand. It sounds like, it reads like a dissertation, like someone, it's very plain and poetic, but it's very much rooted in, like, look at the root system in fungus or mushrooms and plants and, you know, that all of this is what sustains us and how disconnected we've become from that. And it's kind of a call for all people, but kind of focusing on the toxic masculine, how we need to like rethink or just reconnect, go back to connection and having a different sense of meaning in our identity. We're all connected. That is, I mean, the remedy and the opposite of what trauma does, you know, it disconnects us. And here, you know, I hear from both of you being, call it wounded healers. That's how I would identify in some ways. But part of that healing is becoming more whole with ourselves, with our experience, with others, with nature, with animals. And,
it's interesting too how you said that the flower knows that the bee's coming by the sound and stuff and opens up and gives us its nectar or whatever. It's like it's able to give some of it and it's not dying because of it either, you know? I don't know, that just came to me.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, nature works together. I mean, you know, we could kill off a whole species of animals, which, you know, turns the whole ecosystem off into a whole different direction. You know, because it's like, you know, same thing we can do with each other, you know. It's like when I went to school, they said we could blow up the world 3 times with the bombs we have.
Right.
And I thought, is it once enough? What are we building bombs for if we could already blow it up 3 times? You know, I just, it doesn't make sense to me. But there's a lot of things that don't.
Well, you're not alone in that. And in the remedy, the Dalai Lama, I mean, a couple of years ago, he was here in San Diego, and he basically said, you know, we've lived the past century in domination and competition and destruction, and you know the road ahead is all about, you know, our interconnection, our cooperation, and what we can do to sustain, you know, we're our one community.
So, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that, in our own ways, whatever we can do, we are contagious. We're promoting, you know, by our example and by our resources. So thank you both.
Definitely.
I'm going to say good night, everybody. Yeah. And I'm going to hit the music. Is that okay, Victoria?
I appreciate it. Yep. Thank you, Jaime, for coming on. And thank you, Annie, for hosting. And everyone have a good night. See you again on the radio.
Night.
Good night.
that dawn was soon.